5 minutes after one, we're in session. In attendance are Representative Coghill, Representative Ramirez, Representative Dahlstrom. Welcome back. We missed you terribly. Representative Gatto, Representative Holmes is excused, and we're waiting for Representative Lynn and Gruenberg to make their effort in. First up is our good friend Representative Johnson and House Bill 201. Welcome, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And with your permission, Representative Craig Johnson, District 28, with your permission, I'd like to bring Staff Jeannie Osmuses along with me. I am in a committee meeting down the hall. Would like to introduce this, and then with your permission, recognizing that I may not get it, excuse myself and go to resources.
We've been joined by Representative Lynn. We're going to hear this bill and then take it up again in January.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can make that meeting. Mr. Chairman, this is a bill I'm calling Birthday with a Bang. It is a very simple bill, and truly you've heard that many times, but this one really is. What it does is have your carry concealed permit expiration date coincide with your driver's license. This, like most of the ideas that I have, came from a constituent who let his carry concealed permit expire, had to go back and take the test, take the class, and his original request was that we ask the department to notify everyone before their license expired. That carried quite a hefty fiscal note with it, and as a compromise to at least put everyone on the same footing, this will require that the carry concealed permit expires at the same time your driver's license does.
Okay.
It is my hope that we have responsible people that will always get their carry concealed renewed, but in the event, at least they will have no two things they have to do on the same day.
All right. Jeannie, do you have much you'd like to add to that?
Not much more, except in your packet you'll find not only the regulations, cost of class, but you'll find both applications renewal, and at the very end you find your renewal costs throughout the state.
Mr. Chairman, I guess the only thing I'd like to add is that this, as we do not require a carry concealed permit in the state now that any citizen can carry one, this is primarily for reciprocity for the states that where an Alaskan citizen can go outside and carry their permit. They have to have a permit to carry in those states that allow it. Just because you're an Alaskan doesn't give you a permission to carry a gun if you don't have this permit. So that's the purpose for this.
And there are 34 states that allow us to they recognize our permit, 15 that do not.
Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And how many Canadian provinces would that include?
Representative Gatto, I think that would depend on whether or not you can conceal your shotgun, because I don't think they allow handguns in any form in Canada. So if you're good at concealing your shotgun, you might have a shot. That's a little more difficult. And I'm pretty sure Mexico is not included either.
Maybe
Iceland, Greenland. All right. Mr. Chairman, and there was a draft.
You've not been called on yet, Representative Johnson.
Thank
no, April Fool's. April Fool's.
I didn't call you Jay.
You can call me Jay.
It's going to be a rough day.
You scared me, Mr. Chairman.
Under shot.
They shouldn't have gun conversations like that.
Hey.
Oh, I'm sorry.
He's a good shot. I'm not.
I hope I'm as red as you are.
That was good.
Representative Johnson, thank you. You made my day.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Anything to help.
Yes, sir. So that said, Sue Stancliffe is here with DPS to ask any questions. And I do have a note to you, Jeannie, that Mick Manns and Jack McManus are in the Fairbanks LIO to testify on the bill. Are they with us? Do we have anybody online who wishes to testify on this? All right. Are there any questions for the bill sponsor? We're so happy to see you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any questions for the bill sponsor?
You have a co-sponsorship.
You have two. You have two more over here. We're with you.
I appreciate that. Yep.
So
it's not an April Fool's joke, is it, Mr. Chairman?
Thank
Mr. Chairman, I would point out that there, and I think Representative Coghill might have an amendment that is a drafting where they say license, we need permit because we are talking permit, and that's just a drafting.
We have the amendment. Okay, we've been joined by Representative Grunberg. Representative Grunberg, we're taking up House Bill 201. Representative Johnson has just presented. We're going to public testimony. Sue Stancliffe is here with Department of Public Safety. Public Safety supports this bill. And we want to go to Mick Manns in Fairbanks. Mick, are you with us?
I'm here.
Hey, welcome. Ed. Happy April Fool's Day.
Yeah, thank you.
Welcome. If you'll offer your testimony, your name, and then your testimony, Mick. It's nice to see you.
Yeah. Mick Manns, got an office in Fairbanks, live north of Biddles. My comments are that as a former deputy sheriff and a former police officer and having had a concealed carry permit for the state of Alaska, we screwed up and being in the Brooks Range didn't get in time to renew it when we should have. However, my comments are that, number one, the fingerprints never change, so I would think that if you'd already had a permit and already been fingerprinted, that doesn't quite make sense to me. The number two is to set through a class all over again for something that we've already passed doesn't quite seem reasonable, particularly having been in law enforcement and several years in the military. And we have no objection to a reasonable late fee, but it's not so much the money as it is the time to, come in and set through 3 or 4 days or whatever, a school and whatnot, particularly if you're out of town. We're just thinking that there should be a way that that could be worked around to where those of us that have no other reason for not having the permit other than that we were just either out of town or screwed up and did not get in time to do it, that there should be a way of posting some type of a late fee and then going ahead and paying for it, even if it was like double instead of the $50. And I think that's pretty much all that I've got to say, although Jack did write a short note here for me that he would like to have me read in for him, if that's agreeable with you gentlemen.
Yes, sir.
Jack writes, honorable members of the Alaska Legislature, my name is Jack McManus, a retired lawyer who moved to Alaska 20 years ago. I live in Fairbanks and have substantial property at Chandler Lake. I also write extensively on the Constitution of the United States, particularly the Second Amendment. In regard to the concealed permit regulations, I would like to point out in Alaska you do not need a permit. However, a concealed carry permit requires one to take an instructional course with to shoot for record, which we have already done. As your supplicants, we have done this, but because of an excusable neglect or inadvertence, we have not at this time got our permits renewed on time and have lost the permits. We ask you to allow the former permit holders to reestablish your permit by application and perhaps a reasonable renewal fee. However, we have already passed the educational requirements and have shot for record. Thank you, Semper Fidelis, Jack McManus, 907-479-5001. And my son, Monty, also is in the same situation that I am, owns a body shop and occasionally has to go down there and check for safety of the vehicle and the residents and whatnot and so on in the evening. And also had a concealed carry permit. So I guess I could close by saying that that makes three of us that would appreciate any consideration that you gentlemen would give for coming up with some subject or some way to renew without having to drive in from the Brooks Range and set through a 3-day class or whatever. Thank you again, and I think that's about all I've got to say.
Mick, you're welcome, and gentlemen and ladies, this is Representative Dahlstrom is a gun-toting Second Amendment
pistol-packing advocate. Mama.
Yep. we thank you very much for your testimony. Your point was well made on us. We thank the bill sponsor. We have available to answer questions the Deputy Commissioner John Glass from DPS, as well as Kathy Monfreda, and Kelly Howell. Are there any questions for members? I don't see any. We appreciate the common sense behind this bill. With that, we're going to go ahead and close public testimony. We'll bring it back to the committee. Representative Coghill is going to offer amendment number one. Representative Coghill.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'd like to move amendment number one, that is R.1.
Without objection, amendment number one has been adopted. Is there any discussion on HB 201? Seeing none, Representative Gatto, question?
Thank you. Is there any legislation in these states that do not recognize concealed handguns currently in force? For instance, the entire West Coast, California, Oregon, Washington, are all in that list. And those are places that we tend to go to. So they're off limits at the moment. Do any of them have pending legislation or... That's okay if we don't know.
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, I don't know. I'm more concerned about my citizens, unless Washington's trying to pass a gas tax, than I care about theirs. I really haven't looked into what other states are doing. I'm looking after my constituents and yours.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any more questions? Seeing none, Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish to move House Bill number 201. Our version with the attached amendment number one, zero physical note and individual recommendations.
Thank you. And without objection, HB 201 passes from committee. Representative Johnson, Jeanne, thank you very much for taking
time. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate it. Have a great rest of the day.
Great.
Thank you.
Carry green slips with you.
I'll get you one.
Okay, we are next going to move to House Bill 153. I'll remind members that when Senator Pascavant comes off the floor, we'll set this bill aside and have him spend a few minutes with us on House Bill 13, and then we will return to HB 153. Representative Dahlstrom, we need to introduce the CS for House Bill 153.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish to move the CS for House Bill number 153, version S.
Thank you. Without objection, we have CS for House Bill 153 Judiciary before us. Jane, thank you very much for presenting. It's a pleasure to see you today.
For the record, my name is Jane Pearson, staff to the House Judiciary Committee. HB 153 proposes changes to the Open Meeting Act to make it workable for municipal service area boards while preserving the intent of the Act. Generally, the Open Meeting Act requires that all meetings of public bodies are open to the public and that a public body must provide reasonable advance notice of its meetings. The basic intent of the Act is to protect the public's right to know. Currently, there are exemptions that exclude from the open meetings law meetings of juries, parole boards, staff meetings of public employees, among others. There are no exemptions, however, for members of government bodies that also have administrative and managerial responsibilities. This is causing hardship to volunteer advisory board members, such as road and fire service area commissioners, who often find that they must choose between complying with the Act or providing delayed or unresponsive services. First, HB 153 would allow a further exemption to the open meeting law for meetings by municipal service area boards when meeting solely to act on matters that are administrative or managerial in nature. Exempting these boards only when they meet to fulfill their administrative and managerial functions allow them more effectively to conduct business without harming any of the purposes or intent of the Act. Examples of such activities include calling out snowplows, clearing brush, or fixing potholes as needs arise. These advisory bodies would still be required to comply with the Open Meetings Act whenever they meet to discuss any policy or budgetary matter. And in the Fairbanks North Star Borough ordinances, they must also meet publicly four times a year with their service area. Second, the reason for the Judiciary Committee substitute, HB 153, addresses an anomaly in state law by amending the definition of meeting for advisory boards. Currently, the law governing advisory boards is more stringent than the law governing actual policy-making bodies such as the Borough Assembly. HB 153 will allow members of an advisory board to have a prearranged meeting as long as it does not result in a violation of the three or majority rule applicable to policymaking bodies. Members of the Fairbanks North Star Borough are in line to address the bill and answer any questions. Probably the best person to answer questions is Renee Broker, the Fairbanks North Star Borough attorney. Also online are Luke Hopkins, an assembly member, Ron Illingsworth, the Road Service Commissioner, and Kathy Wasserman, Alaska Municipal League Executive Director.
Jane, excellent. Are there questions for the bill sponsor? Perfect. Let's go to Renee Broker. Renee, I've known for a long time. She's our borough attorney for the Fairbanks North Star Borough, and I have been at meetings when this issue has come up where we have three road service people and two of them can't get together for the practical effort of trying to figure out who to hire and where to plow and nothing that is conspiratorial in nature. So I am going to appreciate members directing their questions to the more practical side of this bill's application. And thank you in advance for your cooperation. Renee, welcome. It's nice to have you before the House Judiciary Committee.
Oh, thank you. My name is Renee Broker. I'm the borough attorney for the Fairbanks North Star Borough. And on behalf of our borough, I speak today in support of HB 153. We support it because it fixes two what we believe are unintended consequences of the act without affecting in any way or diluting in any way the very important public policy goals of the act. The OMA already exempts paid employees, and it does that because it recognizes that one cannot perform the day-to-day administrative functions and still comply with the act. You just simply can't stop in a day and decide we're going to have a meeting about whether we fix this pothole or instead fix a culvert. But most service areas, because they're not area-wide functions, are way too small and lack the financial resources to hire employees. So their administrative functions have to be performed by volunteer boards. State law authorizes this. It authorizes boards to oversee the furnishings of the service in a service area. That's all that state law authorizes. When these boards perform that authorized function, which is an administrative function, they are performing work that otherwise would have to be done by paid employees. This bill simply extends that existing exemption, applicable now only to paid employees, to this very narrow circumstance when those same exact functions are instead being performed by a volunteer service board. And I think it's important to recognize that this exemption is very narrow. It is not going to apply to any other of the duties of the board, and that's because all of those other duties are simply advisory. Service area boards are not independent legal entities. They operate under the borough. They can't enter into contracts because they have no legal authority to sue or be sued. So they operate just as any department would, where only the mayor and the assembly can enter into contracts. They operate under the borough's procurement code, so they can't go out letting bids, awarding contracts, those sort of things. All of those things are done by the mayor and under the authority of the assembly. The service area board can make recommendations, and they're required to make a recommended budget to the mayor and a proposed appropriation and tax levy, but that is all an advisory function, and all would have to be done in an open meeting. They can weigh in on specifications for contracts, but that also has to be done in a meeting because that is also an advisory function that goes to the mayor and the assembly, and only the mayor and the assembly can authorize changes. The second change simply removes an unintended anomaly by clarifying that the same numerical standard that applies to policy boards should also apply to advisory bodies. It makes no sense that two assembly members can call each other up and say, hey, let's meet for coffee and talk about an issue that's up before the assembly next week. They can do that, but advisory boards can't. And that's because right now the law doesn't impose any numerical standard. So we'd like to see the same numerical standard applicable to advisory or the assembly made also applicable to advisory bodies. That way everybody understands the standard, there's no confusion, and there's no, you know, sort of subjecting these advisory volunteer bodies to a higher standard than we subject to the assembly, which just causes a whole lot of confusion. And people, frankly, unless they get a lot of training on this, they end up violating it because it doesn't, they don't understand it and it doesn't make any sense. And so we strongly support the bill and urge your support.
Thank you. Are there questions for Renee? Representative Grinberg?
Thank you. Ms. Broeker, and this is Max Grinberg. Do you have in Fairbanks community councils?
No, we do not.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any more questions for Renee? Next, we're going to go to Luke Hopkins. Luke, Assemblyman Hopkins, nice to hear you. It's a shame not to see you. We like having you down here.
Well, thank you very much, Representative Ramirez. This is Luke Hopkins in Fairbanks. I am a member of the Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly. And I, too, am in support of the committee substitute of HB 153 before you now. You have heard very specific testimony previously from our borough attorney. I do want to say that I hear as an assembly member calls from commissioners, volunteer commissioners in our 107 road service areas, plus we have two other types of road service areas, when they are frustrated with the inability for two of them to meet to discuss the administrative duties of, as you heard, determining whether road repairs should be made with an existing standing contract, and that means calling out a contractor in a contract that has already been issued for that function, in reviewing invoices from contractors that are submitted for the work that has been performed, and taking care of other safety issues, as we heard, plowing snow, opening culverts in the springtime when they're frozen up. These are the issues that we're asking for an exemption in the first part of the bill under the Open Meetings Act. In that second part, we assembly members here in Fairbanks hear the peculiar calls that say, why can't two volunteer commissioners, meet on and discuss issues when three assembly members can meet and they're elected and they just don't understand it. And again, when I, myself, a board member of the Alaska Municipal League, when we go through the newly elected officer training, these issues come up, from what I recall, time and time again, about the lack of the same numerical standard for these volunteer service area commissioners. So I ask you to hear our concerns and to support and move this bill forward. So I'm available to answer any questions, and thank you very much for this opportunity.
Luke, we thank you very much, and there's a lot of empathy, at least from the chair, on this issue. I've been, as I say, to the assembly meetings where these issues have arisen, and it's nice to see two consecutive bills that have such a common sense application. I'm so appreciative. Usually this body can't do that so well. Are there questions for Assemblyman Hopkins? I don't see any here at the table. We'll next go to Ron Illingsworth with the 23-mile road service area. Ron, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Welcome. We're so happy to have you. Introduce yourself and your affiliation, please.
Yes. Good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of HB 153. My name is Ronald Illingsworth, and I am the chair of one of the service areas mentioned, 23-mile Slough road service area. Current law places us in the position of, as service area commissioners, of choosing either to comply with the law, to ignore the law, or to find ways of circumventing the law. This should not be an acceptable practice for public law. This bill addresses these concerns. Specifically, because AS 44.62.310 does not exempt road service areas from the public meeting requirement, as it does such things as staff meetings, we are unable to conduct routine administrative or managerial duties without having a week or more notification and a subsequent public meeting. Currently, for example, we have a contract which was established by the Fairbanks North Star Borough Public Works Department to do maintenance on our service area roads. We're responsible for the implementation of that contract, i.e., calling the contractor out to do work that is already in the contract at a rate already agreed upon in the contract. But the service area commissioners cannot have any discussion amongst themselves to call out the contractor without having a public meeting. For example, two road service area commissioners cannot meet on the road while passing each other in a car and discuss the condition of the road. Two road service area commissioners cannot send an email to each other to talk about plowing the road after a snowstorm.
Ron, may I interrupt you?
Yes.
What if they're in the same restaurant, they make eye contact, may they wave at one another?
I suppose they could wave at each other, yes. We can do things, but we cannot talk about road service area business.
Ron, Representative Lynn wants to know, what if they wrote hand signals and they wrote on their hands to one another and then shook hands? Would that violate the Open Meeting Act?
You could have a little white rabbit hop between the two of them and send things. It is still against the intent of the law. Communication about the business of the road service area is precluded by that public meeting law without having a public meeting.
Thank you. Very compelling testimony. Are there any questions for... I
do have a couple of other things would like.
Yes, sir. Please.
Okay. I've been a road commissioner for 10 years in my current residence, and before that I was a road commissioner for 4 years at a previous residence. The road service areas are a fact of life in our region. But the current law precludes us from conducting routine business without breaking that law. Interestingly, to go along with the questions that you had, I can have a discussion with the Borough Public Works Department about our contract, about the contractor, about the conditions of the service area roads, without having any concerns about the public meeting law. I cannot have that same discussion with my fellow commissioners without having a public notice, waiting 2 weeks, and having a public meeting. We do have a requirement, as was mentioned in earlier testimony, for quarterly meetings. Decisions of road service area commissioners are obvious to all the members of the service area. The snow's plowed, the potholes repaired, whatever it might be. We do give reports during our quarterly meetings which cover the costs incurred, recap the actions taken, and so on. So instead of delegating all authority to one person, as is the workaround that many of us use right now, this exemption would allow us to include all of our service area commissioners in the decision process before any action were taken. And that does conclude my testimony, and I am available for other questions if there are any.
Thank you, Ron. Any questions? I don't see any. We appreciate very much your testimony. And now if we could go to Kathy Wasserman here in the room. Kathy, welcome. We're happy to have you here with AML.
Thank you.
Welcome. Happy April Fool's Day. No jokes on you. No jokes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Commissioner, members of the commission. My name is Kathy Wasserman. I'm with the Alaska Municipal League. You got me there because I forgot what I was going to say. First of all, I want to preface my comments by saying that the Alaska Municipal League encourages all of its communities to abide by the Open Meetings Act. We believe they do that, and we certainly don't have any intent on trying to break the laws that are in place. However, that when this seems a bit onerous, Alaska Open Meetings Law says that three people or more constitute a quorum for assembly and council meetings, but advisory groups to those council and assembly meetings too constitute a quorum. And usually those groups are three, the boards and commissions many times only have three members, where the assemblies and councils have six to seven. So by disallowing two people to stop and talk about the condition of a road, what it does in one way is to put that decision-making on one person. And God forbid, as a lawmaker, you know you don't want to be that one person. Also, we believe that, you know, there may be times when a person can stop and talk to someone and hopefully no one will see them, but we don't want anyone to be in that position either. So that's why we're trying to change the law. Certainly, we would like to see this. We support this bill, and certainly we would like to help the Fairbanks North Star Borough do what they do and do it well, especially as they hold the all-time record for road service areas.
Indeed. Indeed we do. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know that this is a question for Ms. Wasserman. Maybe a question for Ms. Broeker or somebody else, and I would just ask if anybody can answer this, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
This deals with Section 2 of the bill. On line 17 and line, twice on line 17 and then again on line 23 and 24, they use the term member. Does that mean members who have been appointed or members designated? Because there may be vacancies, and particularly on a small board, that may be absolutely crucial. And I'm wondering if legally the term member means the members who have been appointed or the members who are authorized.
Let's direct that to Renee Broeker. Renee, are you with us?
Yes, I am. And you have to be an authorized member for it to apply to you. And that's what you see in B is simply borrowed from A, which is above.
No, I understand that. But I hope you understand my question. Let us say we have a board of or a commission or whatever, and it's a five-member board that's authorized by ordinance or statute, whatever it is. But they've only appointed three members and there are two vacancies. Would that require, under the majority, that there be three members present because there are five authorized, and that would require then, if there are only three who are presently appointed, that they all be present, or would that be read as being the three members who have been appointed, which would only require two to be present? Ms. Broeker or anybody else?
We count in that for it applies the same way you have for a quorum. Simply because a seat is vacant does not change the count.
Okay, then if I could ask, I guess I'm going to ask Ms. Wasserman that. Does that cause a problem if there are vacancies? Are there vacancies on these boards and stuff across the state? That would, in my situation where I've hypothetically said five members authorized on the board, two vacancies, would that require, with the requirement of three, be the way most local governments interpret this? And if so, would that really hamstring them?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, whenever there are vacancies, it causes problems. Sometimes to get business done, that indeed, with all due respect, is probably another problem. But as Renee said, the number is based on the number of seats usually, so you don't have the quorum fluctuate with who's absent, who's there, what's going on. So
I understand. If I may continue.
Let me ask you, Kathy, are there a lot of road service areas in the Anchorage municipality?
I don't believe that there are very many, and I'm not as familiar, I have to say that, I'm sorry, I'm not as familiar with Anchorage because they're large enough to operate well.
And if I could direct your question to Representative Grunberg, are there many in Mountain View or Russian Jack?
Not in Mountain View or Russian Jack. There are some in Anchorage, but I'm not concerned about the service areas because Section 2 of the bill doesn't relate to service areas. It relates to the Open Meetings Act generally. All kinds of boards and commissions, and frankly, the Open Meetings Act applies to all governmental agencies and everything else. And so this goes far beyond, Section 2 goes far beyond service boards. And what I'm really asking, since we are amending Section 2 does not just deal with service boards, it deals with all of these things, is that much of a problem that now they have to look to the total number of seats that are authorized, and there may be some vacancies. Is that causing any municipal governments around the state any problem? Through the chair to Ms. Wasser.
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, you know, I can't specifically tell you, or it doesn't come to mind that communities have called and said we've got a problem with vacancies. Usually communities go out and try to actively seek people to fill those boards and commissions.
Okay. That satisfies me. I just was wondering, since we were dealing with this, if that's another problem. I'm satisfied with the
call. Are there any questions for Kathy or for anybody that we have online? All right, we thank you. We're going to close public testimony. Kathy,
thank you
for your help today. We're going to bring this bill back before the committee. Is there a discussion before the committee? Seeing none, Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish to move the CS for House Bill number 153, version S, with attached zero physical note and individual recommendations.
Thank you. And without objection, HB 153 Judiciary moves from committee. We'll take a brief recess. Thank you. We're back on the record. It's 1:45. We have before us House Bill 13. We have not closed public testimony. Do we have anybody online who wishes to testify on this bill? And do we have anybody in the room that wishes to testify on this bill? We do have available to answer questions Andy Carpinetti from the Department of Law, and Doug Moody from the Public Defenders Agency is here. Any questions for these members? I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony. The bill is before the Judiciary Committee, and I'm delighted to host a conversation, a philosophical conversation or a policy conversation about the dollar volume of fees. Representative Coghill, do you have anything you'd like to put on the record?
Mr. Chairman, I was going to have somebody that has worked within the system to come testify, but that didn't work. But I still maintain that and some of these fines, like B misdemeanors, you know, we're going to subject somebody to probably a 90-day jail sentence and a $2,000 fine for a $50 theft. I understand it just got to be equitable. This I think this is the right policy call. I've heard even people, even judges, tell me I didn't go far enough, and so I think. I understand why people want to have a felony hanging over somebody, but I would suggest, and I'd like to get this as a finance committee, because I think what we have to do is prove that with them pleading down to misdemeanors continually by starting up the system that says you get a grand jury, you have to do a DA, you have to have an assigned lawyer, and you started this whole system only to have your hand on somebody and then have them plead down to a misdemeanor. So in the interest of having a legal system that says what it is and actually is less costly and says, look, when you do this, this is truly a misdemeanor or this is truly a felony, I think we need to reset this. It's been near 30 years that we've had this on the books. And the value of merchandise and money has changed dramatically, and I would suggest that these numbers are modest compared to what we should do.
Thank you. And I would augment Representative Coghill's testimony with facts that we heard from the court system. And Doug, if I could ask you to come up here without putting you on the spot, but I just want to refresh my memory as to what is it, following on what Representative Coghill said, what happens for the court system once it's at a felony level, even if it's pled down by the DA, doesn't it trigger a superior court judge to oversee the process as opposed to a district court judge? Can you take us through that just very quickly and refresh me, please?
Doug Wolliver, administrative attorney for the Alaska court system. Mr. Chairman, it depends when the plea agreement arrives. Most of these end up with pleas, as most criminal cases do. But the low-value ones oftentimes don't ever get to the Superior Court. Some of them do, and some of them go through the expensive process, and some of them end up before a Superior Court judge before it's finally resolved as a misdemeanor. But theft, low-value theft crimes are kind of a high-volume activity, and a lot of them are resolved before it ever gets to the Superior Court.
All right. Well, I'm satisfied to have sat with a bill that was filed some time ago, and have talked to law enforcement with the Anchorage Police Department. I spoke to a captain there, and we had an interesting conversation about property crime and the fact that so much property crime goes under-investigated. But the fact remains that we do have a lot of young people that are being made felons because of the threshold, and I'm pleased to incorporate higher limits and to send this on to the Finance Committee as a better piece of legislation that will find its way through Finance and then enjoy more study in the other body and come back to us if changes are made. So I feel like this is good public policy to bat out of this committee and see if it holds up as it winds its way through the building. But to some extent it's arbitrary, and to another extent it clearly raises the bar to levels that I'm comfortable with. So is there any more committee discussion on HB 13? Representative Lynn?
Please excuse me, I had to leave room and some other matter, end of session stuff. And so these figures are the ones that we're going to consider. I have kind of a problem with it. It just seems like we're kind of inflation-proofing crime, as someone said, and I have a real concern with it.
Duly noted, Representative Lynn, and I think Representative Coghill can tell you the last time that these limits were placed was 1970. 70 something, so there it's 30 years and plus, and it's an interesting argument that you make, and I can't discount that argument because I think it's an appropriate argument to make.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to bring it up because I can't support it. I just wanted to say no, I can't. I'm going to tell you why.
Noted for the record, and I think this is precisely what will be the issue as it moves from this body to the other body and then perhaps back to us for a concurrence vote. And so your point of view is noted for the record.
Thank you.
Representative Gatto?
Thank you. Doug, Section 1, lines 10, 11, 12, 13 refers to survival equipment or safety equipment. But they refer to both vessel safety and survival equipment. So we want to make something more intense. What if someone steals a fire extinguisher from a building or damages a fire hose? Is that not essentially doing the same thing? Do we want to, I understand vessels and airplanes, but are we interested more in the safety equipment being removed or just protecting vessels and airplanes to an additional degree?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Cargo?
I could probably speak to that a little bit. My intention was not to go through and rewrite the code because in each section what we have is property value amounts. And so we went through and looked at the property value amounts. There is an honest and legitimate debate on what those property descriptions are. Mm-hmm. I chose to stay out of those so that we could just deal with the property value because it was the value that set whether it was a second degree theft, a first degree theft, fourth degree theft. And what I was looking at is a $50 issue, for example, just short of where you say in there, a $50 value now becomes a C felony. Where you can have 5 years in jail or a $50,000 fine. And so it could be a significant deal. And what you're dealing with in there is public safety, no doubt. But you've set the value at $50. And if we really want to talk about truth in punishment or equitable justice, I think what you need to do is look at, first of all, the property value. But I agree that there's a lot of legitimate debate about the offenses as they're described throughout this whole bill. I chose not to get into that because it would be not just an omnibus crime bill, it would be untenable, unworkable, so heavy you'd never be able to finish the discussion. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a thought.
Very good. And I'm happy for any discussion on this because it's such an arbitrary nature. Are there any other members who would like to weigh in?
Well,
right. Well, seeing none, we Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish to move House Bill Number 13, Version A, with attached fiscal note and individual recommendations from committee.
Without objection, House Bill 13, Version A, moves from committee. It's 5 minutes to two. I think we're surprised with our capacity today. Our intention tomorrow at 1 o'clock is to take up a special meeting on the subject of the Bethel consent decree. Very interesting subject matter, and I anticipate that we're going to go long on the floor tomorrow because of a couple of bills that we have. The hearing tomorrow stems from the trip that the Energy Committee took to Dillingham, and that was short-circuited by weather-related concerns in Bethel. And in the rural communities that the Energy Committee traveled to, we learned that oftentimes there was a single company, or in some cases, two companies that provided fuel oil, generally for space heat for homes, businesses, but also for the generators for kilowatt production. And in Bethel, there was a unique settlement known as the consent decree, in which case a monopoly was broken up to usher in fair competition, and pardon me, possibly. Presumably, and the community of Bethel is less satisfied with the outcome than they had hoped to be. And so we are going to take up a hearing in the form of an overview with our friend Mr. Sniffen from the AG's office. And it's important that we convene. So even if we run late on the floor, I will ask members to join us here and to bring your lunches with you, and we probably will take about 15 minutes to compose ourselves after our floor session, and we'll start. It's the intention of the Energy Committee, and very likely an interim visit by the Judiciary Committee out to the community of Bethel, and so it's going to be very worthwhile because we'll have gavel to gavel here for the presentation for the members of the community of Bethel and the governing body in Bethel to participate in this hearing, and an opportunity to shed light on a significant issue in a lot of our rural communities and some of the regional hubs. And so I would suggest to members that it is of some considerable import, and I hope that we'll accommodate the folks that we have testifying telephonically, but also the folks in Bethel that are very interested in having some legislative oversight on this issue. So that is our meeting that is scheduled for 1 p.m. Tomorrow, and we will have it regardless of when we get off the floor. So with that, at 2 p.m., we're adjourned for the day.